In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
South Dakota students need a little help getting to the future. That's where a community comes in. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, August 19th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we look at the pathway from public school to college and career. A partnership in Sioux Falls is bringing extra counselors into the district paid for by the Promising Futures Fund. Community members leverage philanthropy to meet the school's biggest needs. Here's another Promising Futures project, a new Boys and Girls Club attached to a local middle school. Kids have a safe place to hang out, learn, and launch a new hobby after school. Plus, the emerging research behind cell phone bans in school. Teacher Talk has that conversation later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We've been getting ready for back to school in South Dakota here on In the Moment. We've checked in with teachers, superintendents, and students. Now let's take a closer look at how communities get ready to support classrooms. Steve Hildebrand received the Acts of Excellence Award from the South Dakota Hall of Fame this summer for his work with the Promising Futures Fund. The nonprofit was recognized for its work serving South Dakota kids. Promising Futures believes every student should have equal opportunity in education, no matter their economic status. We're going to learn more about Promising Futures during this hour. Dan Conrad is assistant superintendent at the Sioux Falls School District, and he's the former principal of Jefferson High School. Steve Hildebrand is founder and chair of the Promising Futures Fund. And they join me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. We'll start with Hildebrand sharing statistics that concerned him.
The concern is that not enough kids are going from high school graduation to college or technical school.
Okay.
There's a deficit. So Jefferson High School, where we're getting started, for example, is at 52% this last year of kids going from high school graduation to college or technical school, whereas the statewide average last year was 62%. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with poverty. Our poverty rate is very high in the district. It has a lot to do with immigration. Immigrants have a harder time being able to make that leap to college. And so, you know, this new program, I think, is going to be very successful. We'll pilot it at Jefferson for the first year and then move it to the rest of the district if we get all the money raised. It's a college and career access program, helping kids navigate the path to college, to technical colleges, to the military, expanding opportunities there for full and part-time opportunities in the military, which are incredible opportunities for students. And then the fourth one is helping kids who want to go directly into the workforce to go into the workforce with a real career,
yeah,
a real career opportunity, and so many good pathways to do that.
Yeah. How did Promising Futures begin?
It was in response to the very high rates of poverty. I watched Superintendent Pam Holman over 10 years, who was very intentional about announcing the rate of poverty in the district.
Mm.
And I watched it go from 38% to 48%. It currently sits at 47%. And the poverty rate's probably not going to go away. But what we need to do is just make sure that every kid, no matter what your income, you have the same opportunities, same education, same experiences that any other kid has.
Dan Conrad, let's dive into exactly what's happening, because as Steve mentions, the military, I think of my own experience, and I didn't have anybody, neither of my parents had been to college, but my dad had served. So he was able to give me a pathway to go down to the recruiter, help me navigate what to say yes to, what not to trust as a promise,
sure,
and then help me figure out how to get to college through a military path. I had a guide, even though it wasn't to college, but it was through a military career that led to an education that led me here today. How important is knowledge at home about the pathway to college, the pathway to tech school, the pathway to a career, the pathway to the military? And if the parents don't know that, where does that leave students at?
Very important. It's tough to it's tough to travel the roadmap of life if you don't know where it leads you or what it looks like in the future. And so we're experiential, and our experiences help guide us with where we want to head. And as our young students, there's so much talent in the district, regardless of a kid's background and how we take care of each kid. But part of it is that access. How do we help make them aware of things they never knew about? And sometimes that's in the curricular class that they take, going, geez, I never knew that existed in science or math or reading or social, whatever, you pick the topic. But then also in careers. Just coming over here, we finished the big kickoff for the Sioux Falls School District with teachers at my former school, Jefferson High School. So as I'm coming out, parents are coming in to get their children registered and ready for next year. And just in happenstance, a couple of former parents bumped into me and we started talking. They go like, wow, we're really excited about this college and career access program. And
they knew what about it provided. It, yeah.
Yeah, they knew about it. Like in just 2 months, they knew about it. And the excitement of knowing what opportunity it would provide for their children. And the family is a single parent family working really hard to provide for the family. And the parents are working extremely hard to make ends meet and provide for their family. So it's to no fault of the families around us or things like that. But how do we help families out and help children out to make them aware of what they do not even know? Yeah. And you're right. Like, so the goal is with four college and career access advisors at the high school is to work and partner with kids and show them experiences that maybe they not have had in the past and open their eyes to say, never thought about that. Or give them the power to make decisions to say, now I have choice. I really don't want that.
Right.
And it helps to accelerate that learning curve. So now they're back in our community and they're experiencing success with the career they choose because they've had early exposure to the variety.
Steve, where did the consensus build around college and career advisors in the school district? The idea for this will be the response. This is the way to address that. How did that begin?
You know, we started about 5 years ago taking eighth graders from three of our middle schools to college and college campuses as well as to technical schools to give them a chance to see what they could see, to open their eyes to what's possible, to get them to understand that it's available if that's what they want to do. The trips are phenomenal. It's probably one of the best things we do. People started to say, what about when they get to ninth grade? What are you doing to help them then? And that's when we started to look at this. And this is going to be a game changer for hopefully thousands of kids where we help them. If they have a goal, we want to help them achieve it. And if that goal is college, but financial constraints are the limit, we're going to figure out ways to get them over that and make sure they have that opportunity that they want. There's so many good things to do in life. And there's so many good things that our school district is doing. The Career and Technical Academy is a phenomenal operation that is part of the school district. There's, I can't even remember, 18 different pathways.
Yes.
It might even be more than
that. It might be a few more than 18, for sure. Yeah.
But every kid who goes in and takes those courses are ready for a career-level position in the workforce.
Right.
Coming from high school, there's no cost to the kid. But also, if they wanted to go to technical school, if they wanted to go to college and wanted dual credits, they can do that. And they're paying dual credit prices at a much lower price than they would if they were going to Southeast Tech or to South Dakota State.
So four new staff members then, that they work for the district?
Four new college and career advisors and a program director as well.
And that's all made possible through the generosity and the vision of Promising Futures Fund. Going through and say, how do we provide this? How do we fill a need that's out there? And I think that's where with Promising Futures, leadership of Steve, looking at the big picture and saying, you know what, there's some experiences that we might be able to provide students that are an extension of where the school sits. How do we make that a reality? And so for this upcoming year, it's going to be four college and career access advisors that are going to work with somewhere we hope in the range of 80-ish kids per advisor. And then there's a director helping to support them and guide them through the year of not just exposing to experiences, but then taking the next step. Like, I don't have someone in my corner who has experienced what it's like to enroll in a technical school or a post-secondary school, pick your choice, a college. And I sometimes get stuck And that's the part that gets me stuck from saying I want to do it to getting into the doorstep. Mm-hmm. And so these advisors are now going to say, hey, let me sit down with you and your parents and your family and say, let's help you fill out the FAFSA. Let's help you fill out and access some other opportunities so that we can make that post-secondary reality for you.
Yeah.
And we just, and it's to no fault of the school counselors or the other services we have. It's, this just fits a need to extend it a little bit further than the support that was previously provided.
Yeah. And Steve, you had to ask for a lot of community support. It's an expensive program. We're going to get to another program here in a minute. So this is not the only thing that Promising Futures is focused on. What was your ask to people? And what were you hearing from community members who wrote checks to say, yeah, this is something I want to support?
You know, to get this program kicked off at Jefferson High School, we had to raise $400,000 for the first year. And as we try to move it to the rest of the high schools, it'll be a $1.3 million annual program. I don't know if we can get there. I think we can. I wouldn't have started the program if I didn't believe in the community's willingness to support the work we're doing. You know, we had a couple of people who gave us $100,000 donations, another that gave us a $50,000. Sanford Health gave us a $70,000 donation. You know, I think when you go out and talk to people and tell them that we need to do more to help kids have opportunities, they step up. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of great people in this community, in the state, that are ready to support this.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation exploring how communities partner with public school districts and the impact on South Dakota schools. Our panel discussion today includes Dan Conrad, Assistant Superintendent of the Sioux Falls School District. He's formerly the principal of Jefferson High School. Steve Hildebrand is the founder and chair of the Promising Futures Fund. And we're going to bring Stacy Jones into the conversation now. She is Chief Executive Officer of the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Sioux Empire. She begins here with an update on a new addition to George McGovern Middle School in Sioux Falls.
It is a 16,400 square foot facility. It is attached directly to George McGovern Middle School, and it's a Boys and Girls Club. And the tremendous advantage, it just cuts down all the barriers, right? I mean, it's going to have this amazing dynamic programming. We've got an innovation lab. We've got a gym. We're going to feed the kids every day after school. But it cuts down the transportation barrier. They don't even have to walk outside. Whenever I show people the club, I'm like, these are the two magic doors, the one that walks out of McGovern and walks into the club, because it's seamless, and it cuts down on those barriers. But there is a high rate of poverty at that school as well. So giving those youth this opportunity to be able to experience this dynamic programming and mentorship and tutoring and care and everything after school and on extended care days and during the summer is going to be a game changer. And, you know, Steve and Promising Futures were a huge help in raising the funds to be able to build that building and outfit that building. It was privately funded, so we're really looking forward to opening the doors here on that first day of school. It's coming up quick. We just had our ribbon cutting and great community support. Really, this community is tremendous in supporting our young people.
I was looking through the photos online of the interior of this, and one of the rooms is like there's a gym, and there's, you know, like you said, you know, place to eat and take cooking classes and all these things. There's also kind of a quiet room.
Yes.
That looked like it had some acoustic panels on it.
Yes.
What's that for?
We have two, we call them flex rooms. Okay. And the whole space is designed to be incredibly flexible, the entire club. But the two rooms you're talking about, there's one that we'll use primarily for like tutoring, mentoring, and small groups. And then it has the acoustic panels. And the other one, which you should come over and visit and show us how to do it, is lyricism and podcasting. It's been very exciting for a lot of our young people. It gives them a chance to use their voice, whether they're talking about a major political issue or just their favorite cereal. It gives them an opportunity to kind of share what they're thinking about and feeling. So yeah, one of our rooms is for lyricism and podcasting.
I thought it looked familiar. And
I think it's got Lori Walsh's name all over it.
Yeah, we need to go in there and get some podcasts, hear those voices and what they want to say.
I would
set
love
them up.
To have you. Yeah.
It starts here. We went to Eugene Field and did a podcasting workshop, and they were amazing at it. And we've been playing some of those because they get it. Kids get audio already.
Yes.
So they were just ready. They just needed the equipment.
Yep.
And a few prompt questions.
Yes.
And that's really all they needed. They understood the assignment.
Yes. I would absolutely love to have you there.
And the things they had to say about the world and the future, especially regarding climate and AI. They had big thoughts about what AI should be and what they were thinking about. And these were elementary school kids. I was very, very impressed.
But I think that's what you see when you provide access and you unpack what the possibilities could be.
Yeah.
Whether it's the elementary support and the initiatives with reading that we're partnering with Promising Futures, whether it's the middle school layer with Boys and Girls Club or the high school, college, and career access, there's a continuum and a thankfulness to the community partners to say, let's just get the room lit up and provide kids an opportunity. They'll take it from there. And we've seen that for many years.
I want to talk about this idea of the private partnership with public schools and the way, Steve, that you have found it is about so much more than writing a check. There is a back and forth so that people understand what they are a part of when they support Promising Futures. Tell me how you think about that, because you're kind of the master at that, and it seems like a magic elixir to me, but I bet you have an ethos for it.
You know, the principals in the schools that we support are my bosses, and from day one, we've always had this idea that we need to go and just listen to the principals. They know the needs in their schools. They talk to their staff every day about what their needs are. And the principals very much open up to you. They're not asking for unreasonable things. They're asking for really smart things. One of the first things we did was create a Book a Month Club. And that was over at Lowell Elementary, our first school. And now we're in 14 elementaries with the Book a Month Club. And it's 258 classrooms across the school district where we have community members write a check to sponsor that classroom. Every kid in that classroom gets 9 books over the course of the school year as a result of that partnership. And then we encourage the teachers and the sponsor to get to know each other with the idea that, you know, let's get that sponsor in to read with the kids. Let's have the sponsor support the teacher during Teacher Appreciation Week, all that kind of stuff, and create that relationship. And what I'll tell you is about 95% of those sponsors do it year after year. Mm-hmm. It's their classroom. They take ownership over it, and they're really proud of that sponsorship. And we actually had to add a school this year because we had more sponsors than we had classrooms to sponsor. That says a lot about Sioux Falls. Yeah. But it's a $350 sponsorship for kindergarten through second grade to purchase those books, and then $650 for third through fifth grade because the books are a little more expensive.
Dan Conrad, what does it mean to have support from a community, especially when it's organized like it is through Promising Futures?
Well, when it's organized through Promising Futures, it takes a little of the pressure off, right? But if you think about schools and the role of public education, it is a community event. And you look at the new facilities that we have built in Sioux Falls, whether it's the new Jefferson High School that just opened up, and you walk in there, the classrooms have windows on both sides. It's windows to the outside and windows to the inside. It's no longer meant to be in isolation as if it ever were meant to be in isolation. It's meant to be through partnerships. And whether those partnerships are, some of those require financial resources and support, but a lot of it's the human element and pairing our kids with mentors, adult mentors, and bringing them in. While we appreciate greatly the fundraising support and the filling the gaps that Promising Futures does, that Boys and Girls Club does, at the end of the day, it's the human element that's there. And having our community to come in to say, hey, I am where I'm at today, and I'm a lifelong Sioux Falls kid, 50-some years going on from my days tracking through. But there were adults in my life that made a difference and said, hey, here's what you can dream of, here's what you can think of, and here's when times get tough, the support you can look forward to. Yeah. And that's the role that these fill out. As a public educator, as a community member in the public, knowing that the community of Sioux Falls has always believed that taking care of a child and making sure they have the education so that they have the opportunity to make choices in their life is a community event, that's a powerful piece.
Choices to do the next thing. And having a safe place to go, Stacy, and friends to hang out with after school is a big component of that as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of young people that go home alone or have to watch a younger sibling. And just to be giving them that safe space that they can be, and a space filled with the people, you know, that Dan's talking about, that care about them, that enlighten different ideas. I mean, we all think back to our childhood, right? There was somebody somewhere, a coach, pastor, mentor, teacher, somebody that saw something in you. And that's what's so great about having spaces like this, is that we fill them with those adult mentors like that, mm-hmm. that are doing that for our youth every single day.
Steve, we talk a lot on this show in interviews with people in state government and in different leadership positions about keeping the best and brightest here in South Dakota. And say more about when you're taking kids for college visits, you're taking them to USD, to SDSU, to Dakota State, to Dakota Wesleyan, or wherever. When you're looking for military opportunities, you're looking at the Guard here in South Dakota. Tell us a little bit about the South Dakota focus of Promising Futures.
You know, this College and Career Access Program is going to keep more kids in our state. We have the Freedom Scholarship Program now, mm-hmm. that 10 different South Dakota colleges and universities, public and private, participate in. This is a scholarship where a low-income kid can get $4,000 to $6,000 in financial support. Their only requirement is that they have to stay in the state for 3 years after graduation, or it becomes a loan. So, couple things. Also, the Build Dakota Scholarship, which is a Fulbright scholarship program for a kid to go to one of our four technical colleges. All 14 of those opportunities are going to keep more kids in the state. The opportunity to have this be a loan forgiven to stay in our state is going to keep more kids in the state. But, you know, I'm a born and bred South Dakota guy. I've left four times. I've come back four times. This is home. And Sioux Falls is just a great place to live. There's lots of great places in our state to live. I think the opportunity that we're going to present to Sioux Falls school students, high school students, is, you know, an opportunity to say, if you want to go to Atlanta and go to a school there, that's great. If you want to go anywhere in the world to a school, that's awesome. But there are opportunities in South Dakota that are presented to you that are going to allow you to leave college with a whole lot less debt than you might if you go somewhere else. Today's world, people are saddled with debt, and a lot of it is college kids leaving with $50,000, $60,000 in loans that they have to pay back. And you know, you want to be a school teacher and try to pay back loans at that rate, you know, it's tough to do.
Yeah.
So we're going to provide opportunities where it's not going to be so hard to get along in life.
And Dan, when we talk about these advisors in the school, that might be one of the obstacles or barriers that Stacy referenced, is the perception that this is a debt. This is a future saddled with debt. I know I heard lots of kids when my daughter was growing up through school who said, I can't afford college because I don't want to be in debt. They had internalized that. But they hadn't really sought out, well, will you be in debt? What are the options to avoid that and still get the education that you want?
Yeah. I think part of that is like mastering your story, right? Oftentimes we repeat what we hear or things like that. Well, we repeat our experiences. So if we never had the experience to say, hey, this could be a potential for you, and bring in, so we bring in College and Career Access Advisors, we're bringing in four individuals whose goal is to deep dive every pathway that could be possible for career and college and technical school and possibilities to make one's life enhanced. Mm-hmm. Money is not everything and things like that, but it does add it gives you choice, right? There's some certain things you can choose. So when the college advisors do some of that heavy lifting, and now they are aware of all these different pathways, and they can partner a student's interest, a student's outlook, and we can help change in the narrative on, you can do it if you want to. Here's some things that we have to do, some choices that we have to make, but it's an opportunity for you. And so how do we change that narrative? How do we share the story that it is possible? And with a little, you know, that work ethic, effort, initiative, and just seeing what we didn't know before, mm-hmm. all those things are possible. So the four College and Career Access Advisors provided to the schools, and just the comfort, the support, the knowledge that they're going to provide families and students about the possibilities, and turn away some of those narratives that are like, oh, you can't do this, and change the word to say, well, what can we do? Let's think about the can. What can we do?
How do you measure outcomes in the different areas that you work in? How do you measure this is working, this is not, we're going to make a pivot? Steve?
Obviously, this is an expensive program, and so metrics are going to be important, not just for the kids' future, but also for the future funding of the program. Mm-hmm. So we're going to pay attention to, are we increasing at a significant rate the number of kids going from high school graduation to college or technical school? That'll be number one. Number two is some of our donors are telling us they want anecdotal stories. They want to hear how we helped a kid go from point A to point B and put them on a path of success. And so that's going to be just as important, and we'll be keeping those kinds of stories, and we're happy to come on South Dakota Public Broadcasting and talk about them.
Yeah.
Because I think they're going to be some really interesting stories. You know, a couple of the advisors that we hired are those kids. Mm. They're the ones who no one was paying attention to. No one was helping guide them into their future, and something happened. And we want to be that something happening. So that's going to be really important. But from all of our programs that we do with Promising Futures, watching kids begin that pathway of being able to read and to become passionate readers, and to take those books home and read them at home as well, and share them with their siblings and that kind of stuff. All of those are just they're metrics you don't measure, but they're right. Important places that we need to pay attention to.
And a culture of educational support.
Right.
To what Dan was saying about this public education. This is all of our jobs to support public education, not just with our tax dollars, but there are other ways to support right. public ed.
With the Boys and Girls Club at McGovern, they're going to have the opportunity to measure whether or not attendance is going up for that child.
Yeah.
If tardiness reduces, if test scores are going up, they're going to have tutors in there helping kids with math and science and reading. There's just going to be so many good things happening for those kids who want to be a part of that club. And it's going to be a packed club very quickly because it's such a phenomenal space. If you're a kid, this is where you want to hang out. It is absolutely phenomenal, and the opportunities are going to be extensive.
Stacey, how do you measure outcomes at Boys and Girls Club?
Exactly what Steve talked about. And yes. I think what's so great about the McGovern Club is, again, I've talked about it's attached to the school. Well, that's a little bit symbolic, too. It shows the relationship that we have with the school district to be able to have this facility. And that means we'll also be able to have access to some of that data. So we'll be able to look at young people attending the club and know that if they're club kids and they're attending the club, they're more likely to go to school because you can't come to the club if you skip school that day. If you had in-school suspension, you can't come to the club. So we'll be able to track that. We've seen that with other clubs around the country, that those numbers greatly improve, whether it's attendance and test scores and behaviors and any of those things, because they're in the club with that supportive behavior, being exposed to it. And like Steve said, they're going to want to be there. We had some sixth graders tour just this week, and one of them right away had to FaceTime his mom. He's like, "Mom, I have to be here. I have to be in this space." So that's what's going to happen. It's going to fill up very, very quickly. But the magic's going to be what happens with the staff and the youth and what we get to show them and experience with them.
Yeah. In the district, measuring outcomes is a big question.
Always a big question, right?
Narrow it down to an area that makes sense for this conversation for us. Yeah.
I think the narrow piece for this is, and Steve and Stacey have both said it, attendance impact, right?
Yeah.
I now have an enhanced vision of my why. Why am I here? Oh, I didn't see that pathway before. Now I have it. My why makes sense. I'm going to make some different choices, and I'm going to be here every day. So you might see it in that avenue. A measurement is how many opportunities we provide kids to. We've organized a trip to SDSU, and I know Steve bleeds the Jackrabbit Blue.
Go Jacks.
Right? And I know, but it's also the USD. It's DSU. It's all the
Augustana
universities.
Augustana, Dan. Don't forget your
I know.
Augustana.
I can't forget Augie. I was holding back on that one. But that's the thing.
We're tamping down our Augie because Steve is here.
That's right. But it's not like –
I love Augustana.
There is no bias to it in the fact that the outcome is we're going to increase the number of opportunities kids get exposed to careers, education, and different pathways. Yeah. So you're going to see how many visits did we make out to the new PD center in Sioux Falls, provide kids maybe there's a pathway with first responders.
Sure.
Maybe there's a pathway at a manufacturing industry that we can provide an exposure to. Maybe there's a pathway to a kid's like, gosh, I want to be that welder. I'm going to, my pathways now, I'm going to take those courses at CTE. I can be a certificated welder. And now, boom, right upon high school graduation, I'm making X amount of dollars. I have that career that I am passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so you're measuring it on attendance. You're measuring it on the amount of exposures we have for kids. And then the third thing is, how many kids did we take from the entry point and help them get to the doorstep of that next college, wherever they enroll? How do we get them in the doors? Because sometimes we're all fired up and then summer hits. And then what happens during those June, July before August when they enroll in college? Our access advisors are going to be available to make sure that we finish and get them to that doorstep and help them get in.
We've been talking about how community members band together with nonprofits and public education classrooms to help kids access the education that they need. You heard Steve Hildebrand there. He's founder and chair of the Promising Futures Fund. Dan Conrad is assistant superintendent of the Sioux Falls School District. And Stacy Jones is chief executive officer of the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Sioux Empire. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Kids are headed back into the classroom this week. Cell phones, not so much. Last week on SDPB's Teacher Talk, we discussed the complexities of cell phone bans, what works, what doesn't work, and what kids are telling us about why it matters. This week, we will follow up with a closer look at what research is beginning to show us. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She's also adjunct professor at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education.
It is complicated because we can't just say phones are banned and then all of a sudden every kid complies and every teacher complies and life is a utopia.
Yeah, this is so much part of our culture that we have to think this through. Plus, Jackie, you pointed out that these decisions should be made based on research, and that research is still emerging. So part two is what emerging research says about cell phone bans. Mm-hmm. And you can find a link to all the research that we're going to talk about on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. Jackie, you did some diving. Tell us some of the things that you found. Where do you want to begin?
I did do some diving. I want to start with a disclaimer that says this is not my area of research. So I am not personally researching cell phone bans and their implications in the classroom. But after our conversation last week, it's been showing up kind of in my area, too, where this emerging research is coming out, because we have had cell phones for a relatively short time and then policies on cell phones in schools for a relatively short time. And so they're it's just now becoming measurable to see what the impacts are and what best practices are for cell phones.
So some of the ways you measure outcomes in education have to be graduation rates and test scores. Are there other things that I'm not thinking of that when you are measuring things in education, what are you already set up to measure?
There's so many different approaches in research methodology. The things you're talking about are quantitative test scores, numbers, results, data that we can look at. You know, if a school, like a very simple, if one school has cell phone bans, do they graduate at a higher rate than a school that does not have cell phone bans? And then you also have to factor in all of the other complicating factors of what state is that in and what is the population of the students there and how would that play into the results of this study? So complicated in that way. And then there's qualitative measures. So you can conduct surveys, you can ask students, you can ask teachers, you can ask administrators what their lived experiences are and then see what trends emerge from those conversations. Are people saying similar things across the lines that we can kind of say this is the general consensus or themes that are emerging from talking to people about these bans?
Yeah. Gina, what would you add to that, even as a teacher in the classroom, where you're thinking about measuring outcomes from a qualitative and quantitative way?
The qualitative would seem like it's the simplest, most reliable. However, there's so many factors that go into student achievement. And to just say phones are the factor that impacted student achievement is really a hard thing to do because there's pandemics that affect it. There's community issues. There's family issues.
Right. Whether you ate breakfast or not, maybe. So you can't do a study with rats and cell phones in the classroom.
So it's only doing a
real world kind of measurement. So it would be unethical to say these kids had a cell phone ban and they didn't graduate.
It's again.
You see where I'm going
again,
there.
Again, it's complicated.
Yeah.
The phrase is correlation is not causation.
Yeah.
Just because these things match up and are correlated doesn't mean it caused it. So, and that's what you're pointing to there. I then am very excited about the research that Angela Lee Duckworth, who's one of my favorite researchers and just all around very interesting people, she recognized what this conversation is happening nationwide and that people are implementing different kinds of cell phone bans. They're coming at it from many different angles. And so she is currently conducting research to just ask teachers and administrators to input the data into their form. What are the policies at your school? How does it work? What are some of the things that you're seeing? And so she's collecting the data nationwide right at the present moment. It's called Phones in Focus. Any educator who's listening, any administrator who's listening can go onto her website and take the survey to contribute to her body of work.
Yeah. And I did it.
Did you?
Okay.
Tell us about it.
I did. And so it's more qualitative because you're giving your estimates and your experiences as a teacher. And I would say don't do it until – it's best to do it when you've experienced a change in policy and make sure you've experienced both types of policy.
Okay.
So, for instance, it really is too early for me to do it because there's been a change in policy in my school, but I haven't fully experienced that.
Okay. So you're going from one policy to the next, but you haven't really seen how it plays out.
Right. And so it looked to me like there's a big comparison between what was it like with this policy versus this policy.
Okay. That makes sense. All right. We're going to get back to Angela Duckworth's work in a moment. But I want to go through, Gina and Jackie, some of the other studies that, Jackie, you have pointed out on this blog, which is a study out of Texas at first from West Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about bell-to-bell phone ban use.
Yes. So I read about this study on my favorite publication, Education Week, which I cite often here. Mm-hmm. And they referred to Bridget Whaley's West Texas A&M University study. And she was studying Texas high schools that had a bell-to-bell ban, meaning that students could not have their cell phones all day. And they put them in pouches, which is a practice that I've heard about in many different school districts where students kind of have to put their phone in a locker or a pouch or some sort of safe away area, and then they can't access them until, depending on the school district, till they say.
Right.
At this school that she studied, it was that they checked them in at the beginning of the day and they picked them up at the end of the day. That research at that particular high school, she found that there were fewer classroom distractions and that there seemed to be more face-to-face interactions among students. But they didn't really have any conclusive academic outcomes, and it does sound like the consistency of the policy enforcement impacted the study. So it doesn't sound like every teacher required every student every day to put their cell phone into the pouch, which is, having been in that classroom, I can very much understand how that takes place. We're talking about human beings. So the idea that it would be implemented at a 100% perfect execution rate would be, I don't know. I can't imagine of anything in education that goes that way.
Right. And so, Gina brought that up last week. That was one of the challenges here, was that teacher, I'm going to spend my energy on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes there's more pressing issues, actually.
Right. Yeah. Okay, keep going, Jackie. Yeah.
So that's pretty much what that study found, is that there was decreased classroom distractions, there was increased face-to-face interactions with students, and that they couldn't really conclude anything about academic accomplishments or achievements based on the study.
The Digital Wellness Lab Review. Tell us about this one.
This one I also found on Education Week. So this Digital Wellness Lab Review took in multiple studies from that were kind of at the smaller scale and just did a review of them, meaning they just read through the studies and tried to find if there were trends that came across the various studies. And they found that there is a reduction in multitasking, so students can focus on one thing at a time, and that can be correlated with better test scores. But the studies themselves didn't say students who didn't use their phones during the day had better test scores. They said students who didn't use their phone during the day were better at focusing, and students who focus better generally get better test scores. And then they also, though, found that there are benefits to cell phones, particularly for low-income students who then have more access to the internet and other tools. And so they're created a little bit more technology equity by being able to have cell phones.
In school, because some of those students might be going home and not have access to technology. School might be the only place that they have it. Whereas the students with a higher income presumably might go home and catch up on all the lost technology time. Okay, interesting.
And these studies, too, were not able to conclude one way or another if there was any impact on academic or student learning.
All right. And then the students, what the students have to say. And Gina, you really talked about this in the first part of this two-part series. What the students have to say about this matters because they're the ones who are using the devices.
Yeah. For some of them, it's an issue of feeling safe and feeling like they belong. And we know from Maslow's hierarchy of needs that meeting physiological needs, safety needs, and belonging needs have to happen before really deep, rich academic learning can occur. So a lot of students' arguments would be that the phone helps them feel safe and that they belong.
Right. They're not fighting that anxiety all day or that connectivity. Okay. Jackie, you found an Atlantic article talking about what students have to say about this. That's an important perspective.
I thought this article was phenomenal. It's called What Kids Told Us About How to Get Them Off of Their Phones. And what the students were saying is that they feel that they have more freedom online than they do in real life. So, for instance, they can play the game Roblox and interact freely with other people who are playing the game at the same time. But they are not permitted to go out in public on their own. Right. So they're supervised in public and they have more freedom online is their perception.
But online they can meet any stranger there is. Right.
Right. I mean, there is that depending on the parameters that are set up for them in their life with their parents or guardians program settings.
Yeah, that tracks with that feels very real.
Yes.
That feels real. Growing up when I did 80s, 90s, there was a real fear of people abducting children. And when that happened to Jacob Wetterling, that especially was driven home. So I can see why people have the fear, but I wish kids were outside more and playing with each other. And
well, it's probably more than just a fear of the worst happening, the unthinkable, the abduction. It's also a fear of not knowing where your kid is, not knowing whether they fell off their bike, not knowing... Yeah. I mean, all these other things that parents would be concerned about. And so kids are saying, yeah, I can't take a... I remember in high school, there was a kid who just moved to town. His dad was a pastor. And we all were going for a ride on a Saturday morning on the bike trails. And we asked him to go with. And his father said, no, he wasn't going to allow him to ride on the bike trails by himself. And we're like, well, you're not by yourself. You're with us. You know, we're friends going for a ride on the bike trails. And he was like, absolutely not. They were new in town. I don't know how that person grew up or anything, but I remember learning the difference between parents who would let you just like take a bike ride and parents who weren't. And so then if you have a computer game where you can go where you want to go, that might feel liberating.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the article also said that there seems to be the narrative from the student's perspective that kids are addicted to their phones, they always want to be on them, and that they can't go without. But when asked if they to pick their favorite way to spend time with their friends, one being in person, unstructured play, like shooting baskets or playing in the neighborhood or just being in a little league game, something like that, that was pickup, not something that was organized by adults, but like so little league is maybe not the right example, a pickup baseball game, for instance, they would choose that over interacting online every time. That was the clear winner. And so the students are saying it's the freedom that we're longing for, according to this article. It's not that we're addicted to our phones. We want the freedom, and that's where the freedom exists, is online.
So, Jackie, does that extend to the classroom, that students would like more freedom in the classroom to make more of their own choices for how they learn, how they demonstrate their understanding?
This article does not go into that. This is purely related to phones and what students are saying about their phone use, not necessarily in the classroom. I think that assumption could be made, but that the article doesn't indicate one way or the other.
But it does bring up the important point, which is student cell phone bans that are successful will most likely have student input.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. How many decisions?
Ask them. Yeah.
Yeah. How many decisions do we make at school without ever consulting with students? How many times do we assume we know what students want and we haven't really asked them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's fascinating.
It is. And that's what I appreciated about this article is I hadn't thought about why do they think they are on their phones? And pretty singular voice, it's not unanimous, but it seemed like the overarching message coming from students that were interviewed in this survey was we want more freedom and the freedom exists on our phones.
Hmm. Which goes back to what we were saying last week about how our culture is designed. When you say a pickup baseball game, especially baseball in the town that I live in, there are fewer places for that because most of those fields have been consolidated into a complex mm-hmm. where structured, adult, organized baseball games are played. Mm-hmm. I don't know where in my neighborhood kids would go for a pickup baseball game unless mm-hmm. they want to play at a recess, like a blacktop, school recess playground. That's the word I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. Unless they went to the local playground. Mm-hmm. Probably be easier to play basketball at the local playground than to play baseball.
It makes me think about recess too.
Mm-hmm. And right.
How quickly we lose recess.
Exactly. The importance of recess, the importance of that unstructured mm-hmm. time.
Where they learn
right.
how to use unstructured time.
And another question then would be if they're using their phone to look things up, what's their access to the library? In the school day, what sort of access to information they have that's not information on their phone? If you're going to do research, how much time do your student get to go to a place, i.e. the library, where they can sit? Just yesterday or last week, I was talking about libraries and newspapers, and I'm like, libraries and research mm-hmm. for kids and cell phones. You shrink that library, you're shrinking all the access to stuff they have because, it's on their phone, but now you've made the only place they can find it on their phone. And now they have to always be on their phone.
I mean, I have not been in a high school classroom in some time, but my students went to the library once a week. I mean, but also that makes sense given who I am and the subject matter that I taught. Yeah. So, I'm a big fan of taking students to the library. Talking to the, what's the word, preaching to the choir here for me.
But even reference books. Now I'm really going to go off on my kick. But as a journalist, I want to be surrounded by dictionaries and AP style guides and how much of that has been moved to online. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have to spend as much screen time if I had those reference books in front of me.
It's true,
So there's that balanced technology use is what we're getting at here. Balanced technology mm-hmm. use.
For libraries to maintain those reference books and keep them updated, that's very expensive. Mm-hmm. We certainly are teaching students how to use databases, which our libraries subscribe to. And so there they can get sources that are reliable and peer-reviewed. Mm-hmm. So we are showing them how to do very important academic research or just reliable research.
Yes. I'm just giving a shout out to librarians.
But
I love that.
I do miss the days myself of sitting in the library and going through the reader's guide to periodical literature.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I understand that there's databases mm-hmm. and you're not going to subscribe to every print magazine. You're mm-hmm. going to have a database to that. I mean, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying, access to time to do research outside of your phone, because sometimes the fastest way is to quick check in. And look something up on your phone.
Well, and research shows that students tend to learn better, to understand the information better when they're reading from paper than from a screen.
That's Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. There's more to Teacher Talk. You can find the full Teacher Talk segments online at sdpb.org/teachertalk or just subscribe to the Teacher Talk podcast. You can find it on your favorite podcasting platform. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thanks for listening.